I'm Daniel Gross, Executive Editor of Strategy and Business. Welcome to our podcast, Talking My Book. Every 2 weeks, we sit down with authors of exciting and interesting new books about business, economics, globalization, and management, and have a conversation. Today, our guest is Jonathan Tepperman. Jonathan is the managing editor of Foreign Affairs. He's a trained lawyer, which we are not going to hold against him today. He's worked for many years at Newsweek. His new book is The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline. It's published by Tim Duggan Books, and I'm grateful that it has brought him to our studios high above Park Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. Jonathan Tepperman, welcome.
It's great to be here.
So what's refreshing about your book is, I think, as follows, that in recent years, starting with the financial crisis, the slow recovery, the serial foreign policy debacles that we've had, so much of sort of smart books have focused on what has gone wrong with globalization and the establishment and how irredeemable and irreparable everything is. To be an optimist, to believe that there are things in the system that work, that the future is better, marks you as a contrarian, which is a pretty strange state of affairs. But in this book, you're really making the case for optimism.
Yeah, that's right. Not just a contrarian, I guess, but an upbeat contrarian, which is even stranger today. The book is set against this conventional wisdom that you just referred to, this idea that we're living in a time of terrible and maybe even terminal decline, that everything is getting worse by the day, and we may have already passed the tipping point where we can turn things around. I don't buy that. And the book came out of an intuition and a sense of frustration that I felt with that conventional wisdom. I set out to write the book in order to actually prove this intuition that I didn't have evidence for before I started, that things are not so bad, by looking at the few countries that are thriving when so many others are struggling, and then trying to figure out why.
So you go through 10 big problems: inequality, immigration, Islamic extremism, the easy ones, civil war, corruption. I don't want to go through all of them here because I want people to read the book, but I do want to look at a couple of them. One of your chapters starts in Brazil, which, again, if you read the paper, it's a shambles. They have Zika. They have the Olympics were sort of a mess. They've just had a coup of sorts. Brazil is the first chapter on fixing things. What went right there?
Right. Well, the problem with Brazil was inequality. And I decided to put that problem at the beginning of the book because it's such a defining problem of our age. But the fact remains, between the year about 2000 and 2010, Brazil made stunning progress in this one area in reducing inequality. It managed to lift about 40 million people out of poverty and into the middle class, and to reduce income inequality by about a third at the same time that it was growing in virtually every other place on the planet.
Right, and this is a program called Bolsa Família, which, you know, you don't need a TED talk on this. The plan seemed to be give poor people money.
Yeah. I know. It sounds stunningly simple. The amazing thing was that it was incredibly controversial at the time that Brazil started, around 2000, because the conventional wisdom in developmental economics was that you can't give the poor money because they'll blow it on, you know, cheap trinkets or cigarettes or booze. You need people with PhDs in development to figure out how to spend it on their behalf. Brazil's president at the time, Lula Inácio da Silva, who had grown up poor himself, he thought differently. It also happened to be, ironically, an article of faith among conservative economists, I should say, that this was the best way to deal with poverty. But it was not one that Lula, a man of the left, was ever expected to embrace. Sure. So the premise for Bolsa Família was that it doesn't take very much money to make a big difference in the life of the poor. And so the government started giving poor people, if they lived if their income was below a certain level, monthly stipends. But it wasn't just a handout, and this proved critical to its political success in the country. Lula imposed three or four conditions, counterpart responsibilities, or contrapartidas, as they were known in Portuguese. But in order to qualify, not only did you have to be poor, but to stay in the program, you had to make sure your kids were immunized, that they attended school 85% of the time, and that moms and kids got regular checkups. But it also played a very critical political role, which was to show skeptical members of the Brazilian public that it wasn't just a handout, that the Brazilian poor had to do their part as well. And that helped sell it as a sort of a social compact instead of just a handout.
Right. And of course, the social indicators and the economic indicators that show, you know, when you give poor people money, they will consume and makes your economy go.
That's exactly right. So you had this initial political compromise, which helped seal popularize the deal. But then you had this economic benefit, which very quickly became evident to the whole country. And that's not only did it take poor people and make them middle class, it took poor people who were excluded from the markets and it made them market players. So all of a sudden, you were putting money into people's pockets who had never had it before. And as Lula told me when I interviewed him about the program, 80% of recipients bought a refrigerator. And 79% of them bought a dishwasher, and 50% of them bought a television. And so all of this helped the broader Brazilian economy boom at the same time that it was helping poor people.
Now, you note that more than 63 countries have sent experts to Brazil to copy its model. How many have implemented it?
About 40 to date. Almost every country in Latin America, I think every country in Latin America, and then countries as far afield as Turkey and Bangladesh as well.
The publisher of The Fix has kindly provided us with two copies of the book, which Jonathan Tepperman has signed, and which we'll be giving away to listeners. If you send an email to gross_daniel@strategy-business.com, that's gross_daniel@strategy-business.com, we'll enter you in a drawing for a free copy. You know, Jonathan, we used to jokingly refer to Tom Friedman as Air Miles, because he would... premise of this column would
right.
be flying off. It seems like you racked up your share in doing the reporting. And again, I think what I like about this is this idea that the solutions, they don't come from Silicon Valley or MIT or Harvard Business School. They're coming from Brazil. They're coming from Botswana,
right.
which I would assume very few of our listeners are familiar with. This seems to be the rare country in sub-Saharan Africa, or maybe anywhere in the developing world, that has not really succumbed to the resource curse.
Right.
How did Botswana manage to avoid that?
Right. So as you said, there are some exotic geographic sources for these solutions. But what's also exotic about them, I think, is that they all come from government, and that's not something that many people talk about today. As you say, Botswana is one of the few countries in the world that enjoys vast natural resource wealth, and yet hasn't suffered all of the political and economic pathologies that ordinarily come with it. Botswana is the world's largest exporter of diamonds by value. Its largest mine alone in 2014 exported 2 metric tons. Enormous quantities. And when you see that, especially in developing countries, that kind of enormous amount of wealth just being pulled out of the ground, you usually get also enormous levels of corruption, of political dysfunction, of civil conflict. Botswana has none of that. It's a solidly middle-income country with very high levels of literacy, something like 87%, regularly scores as the most or among the least corrupt countries in all of Africa.
So how do they manage? Does the government control
it absolutely
the mine
did.
And all the resources?
No, since the beginning of Botswana's diamond boom, which started in the late 60s, just a couple of years after the country became independent, the mines themselves have been run by corporations, but the government has always very, very carefully monitored those partnerships and has done a number of things on the economic front right to make sure that it gets the most out of those deals, including over the decades increasing its share from the take of those mines from about 10% of what De Beers earns to about 80% today. But Botswana has also done a big number of very unsexy but very important things to improve basic governance to ensure that all the money sloshing around in the system can't have the distorting effect that it normally does and can't be stolen. So what am I talking about? Things like strong independent institutions, lots of transparency and accountability, decision making by consensus. So no individual government minister in Botswana can make a big spending decision on her or his own. These decisions all go through cabinet. So everybody is constantly watching everybody else. And that's a tactic that's proved enormously effective.
So, you know, there's a line, I think it's from the Talmud, that says, you know, when talking about the sort of sum of the Bible, it says, you know, what is hateful to you, don't do to your brother. All the rest is commentary.
Mm-hmm.
The recurring theme, one of the recurring themes is don't have corrupt institutions.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest is commentary. That seems to be wherever you are in the world, whatever the problem you're trying to attack, it seems that sort of corrupt institutions, that seems to be the thing that makes a difference.
Yeah, it's definitely a big one. I mean, so all 10 chapters are stories of governments in a particular moment solving a big problem. But what Botswana and a bunch of the other models show as well is you can't just rely on people to do the right thing. And so there's a lot of emphasis on creating guardrails in one way or another to ensure that even if people don't do the right thing, that the system will nonetheless thrive. So, you know, I have a line in the book about how if idealists trust, then realists trust and verify. And that's what happens in every one of these chapters.
Speaking of realism, you know, many of the countries you're dealing with, you have a chapter about Rwanda and reconciliation after the genocide, and Singapore dealing with corruption. Many of these countries are not or were not democracies in the way that we think of the U.S. and Canada and Europe as democracies. So we have this view that you got to be, you know, if you want free markets and all the things that and transparency, the things that make these things work, you really need to have a level of press and political freedom like we have here or in Europe. And many of these, your case studies, are not necessarily democracies in the way that we would regard them sitting here in New York.
Right. So a couple points. First is, it's a few, in fact, of the countries that aren't democracies, really Singapore and Rwanda. I also tell the study of South Korea and its basically nonstop economic growth from about 1960 to today. South Korea has kept its economy growing faster and for longer than any other place on Earth. But it certainly didn't start out as a democracy. And for its first about 30 years of its boom, it was an authoritarian dictatorship. But you're right. Democracy is, I would argue, as you do, essential to achieve the kind of long-lasting and high-level economic success that we enjoy here in the West. And that's one of the reasons I made sure to include the South Korean story in my book, because South Korea did manage to grow for about 30 years as a dictatorship.
Right.
But it was just at the point of stalling when it made the transition to democracy. And I and a lot of other people argue that South Korea would not have been able to continue growing unless it had democratized.
In his book, The Fix, How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline, Jonathan Tepperman focuses in part on Botswana and how that country in sub-Saharan Africa has managed its growth responsibly. In Strategy and Business magazine earlier this year, we published a great article, A New Map for Business in Africa. In the article, Jorge Camarada, Peter Hoytink, and Miles Puttergill outline the prospects for Africa as a whole and highlight how companies need to understand the distinctions between the types of markets within Africa and tailor their strategy accordingly. I highly recommend it. Another, I think, thing that pops up is that some of the countries you're talking about, are that geography, and in some cases geology, are a really important factor. So you talk about, you know, Botswana having the diamonds, right? And that's obviously a circumstance of the rocks that happen to be there. You talk about the shale revolution in the U.S., where we have these immense resources. You talk about, you have a chapter about Canada and how it hasn't had the kind of problems we have with immigration, but you also note that illegal immigration isn't really much of an issue because they're not going to swim across,
right.
People are not going to swim across the very North Atlantic. I mean, you know, and we're certainly not going to flee the United States to Canada en masse. So how much do sort of matters of circumstance, of those types of circumstances,
right,
play into the themes of what you're writing about?
So, you know, one could argue that each one of the countries that I wrote about got lucky in one or two key ways, as you could about any country that's been successful. But I tried very hard when I was selecting the countries that I would focus on not to pick ones that were so well endowed by the fates that other countries couldn't hope to follow their model. So, for example, it's true that Canada doesn't have much of a problem with illegal immigration. The rate is about 3 to 6% in Canada versus something much higher in the United States. But when you compare Canada to the United Kingdom, for example, which is also surrounded by water and also has an illegal immigration rate of about 3 to 6%, in other words, exactly the same as Canada, and yet you've noticed the fact that Britain, the public polls suggest that opposition to immigration is 2 to 3 times higher than it is in Canada, that starts to suggest that it's not just natural factors that make the difference, but smart government policies.
So another kind of intellectual question that your book raises is this dichotomy between you know, what we used to call the great man or woman theory of history, the ability of individual to make a difference at a country and global level on the one hand, and then these kind of vast structural forces. And, you know, everybody in the sort of thought leadership world today will talk about, you know, we got digitization, you got your urbanization, you got your flows of people, you got your demographics, aging, that those kind of these immense forces that are apparent everywhere and are really changing the way we work, govern, etc. That's what we're grappling with. That's how the changes happen. They're all sort of pushing on everything. On the other side is the ability of a single person to lead a movement, to roll out a policy, to create a business or a philanthropy that changes things. And anyway, it's clear to me on what side you come down on. But I guess the question is, how much faith should we have in the ability of an individual to kind of push back or dominate or ride the waves of these vast structural forces?
Thank you for asking me an intellectual question. I'll try and give you an intellectual answer. So the book is meant as a defense of human agency and the ability of the right people under the right circumstances to actually get things done, despite all of the structural and sort of tectonic forces arrayed against them. And what a number of these stories suggest, the takeaway, one of them, as cheesy as it sounds, is that we shouldn't give up hope, because individuals who are able to, you know, manipulate both the political and the policymaking process can still make enormous progress, assuming that they can find other like-minded individuals to work with.
And we see this a lot in the business world, that, oh, this company was destined to fail once X happened. Well, you know, a lot of retailers are going to go out of business because of the rise of online retailing, but a lot of them will survive. The difference in there, that is the nub of the story and how you understand how
things happen. Yeah, that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, people matter. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, like companies, countries face crises all the time. That's nothing special. What distinguishes the stories in this book is that at moment of crises, all the leaders of these countries, or in one case a city at the moment, were smart enough to realize the extraordinary opportunity that crisis afforded them and to seize it. And had the right people not been in those places at those moments, it's not at all guaranteed that things would have turned out the way they did.
Yeah, so as I, you know, conclude, when we finish the book, I think it's what people should take away is that it's not about perfection, the perfection of a system or a person or the actual policy. It's about kind of learning to live with what you have and then trying to make incremental or, in some case, larger improvements. And I mean, do you think that people anticipate and want a perfection, a level of perfection from our systems that just isn't attainable?
Often, yes, although I think you could argue that things are so bad today that people might settle for you know, some simple progress. So I, as you say, I argue in the book that we can't and we shouldn't let the great be the enemy of the good, and that one of the things that all these leaders did was show a readiness to embrace messy solutions. And indeed, a lot of the leaders in this book were messy people themselves, with plenty of individual flaws, but they managed to get something right.
Indeed. Well, you do know, Jonathan, that it is a messy world, but this book is anything but messy. It's a very neat and concise and well-constructed argument, and I recommend it to all our listeners. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Jonathan Tepperman for joining us. Again, his book is The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline.